Send to Brittany. Brittany. There we go.
Is the ice maker going, or is there a murderer in the house?
It's the ice maker.
Oh, okay, thank you.
I just kept thinking about that when we were in the woods, and I'm like, and I'm just like, man, is that a squirrel? Or a demon? And just hearing, and then just imagining hearing a voice out of the woods. It's a squirrel. And you'd be like, thank
you. Definitely a squirrel.
Oh, God.
Kayla.
Could be I'm easier, more easily amused when I've been drinking in the woods.
Yes. I think we are all more easily amused when we've been just sitting around drinking in the woods. Everyone, and welcome to episode 75 of Left of Skeptic. My name is Brittany Lind.
And I am Kayla Moria.
And we are a paranormal podcast.
Yes, we are.
Kayla, how was LibFest?
LibFest was great. Can't go wrong with beer and friends in the woods.
Nope. And music.
And music. Well, I mean, the music is great. Don't get me wrong. But the music is also great because it's my friends playing
in the
music
in the woods
while you're drinking beer. And everybody's relaxed and off their phones, and it's very nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I took 4 pictures the entire time. One was of Thor's set, and then the other one was as I was driving away because the sun was pretty as it was hitting through the trees.
I took almost no pictures because I just left my phone. I was enjoying just sitting there. Had a whole conversation with my friend John, discovered that we're both cancers, and then we related to the ways that helps and hinders our lives. And then I believe something along the line, you said something, I don't know what exactly you said, but we were talking about the podcast, and then John said something like, yeah, you are a Leo. And I was like,
I don't remember what it was, but I do remember that moment. Because, yes, I was there for that conversation. It was you, John, and other Steve, all cancers. So it was 3 cancers and a Leo.
Oh, yep. And then after we discovered that, it was like, oh, yeah, that's like a sitcom.
Yeah.
3 cancers and a Leo.
But I think at least twice he went, yeah, you're a Leo. Yep.
Well, I was there the whole weekend. That was my whole weekend. It was very relaxing and nice. But you kind of dipped in and out for a little bit. How was your weekend? Was it good?
It was fine. The couple hours I was at LibFest, it was really fun.
Nice.
Then I came home so that I could go to bed and get up and do work.
Probably way less bitten by mosquitoes.
Oh, yes. I have very few mosquito bites, and I'm very happy about it. I did not have to sleep in a tent. I did not have to worry about whether or not the squirrel sounds were actually demon sounds. So, you know, it was fine. Let's see if I remember to keep that beginning part in here. Otherwise, that's going to be a really confusing statement.
True enough. Well, seeing as there's not all that much to talk about, I think we could just hop on into the story. But first, we should probably get a word from our sponsors, eh?
Let's do it. Got this leftover margarita seltzer from LibFest. It's warm. It's been sitting in my car this whole time. Let's see what it tastes like. Oh, she's a tough one to open.
It's a tough nut to crack. Summer is here and beer gardens are back at the Great Lakes Aquarium. Every Thursday night in July and August, head on down to the aquarium at 353 Harbor Drive in Duluth to enjoy food, beverages, and live music in their outdoor beer garden space with spectacular views of the Duluth Harbor and aerial lift bridge. It is free to attend, and all ages are welcome to enjoy the local food vendors and performances from a Duluth Symphony Orchestra ensemble. But you must be 21 years or older, obviously, to enjoy the $5 Earth Rider beer and wine. To stay up to date on events, follow Great Lakes Aquarium on Facebook and Instagram, or visit their website at glaquarium.org.
And we're back.
Brittany, I was looking through our episode list while I was trying to figure out what I was going to cover this week, which of my half-written stories I was going to dive into.
And finish. Yeah.
I learned that in nearly 75 episodes, we have never covered a location in Delaware.
Oh, thank God. Oh, my God. I also picked a location of from a state we've never covered, and I got really nervous for a second there. Okay, Delaware. Oh, whew. Okay. If you saw my eyes get really big, that's why I'm like, what? Anyway, Delaware. Sorry. Yeah, Delaware. Cool.
So that is how decided what to cover this week. I'm going to tell you about two locations this week.
Okay. As is your way.
But first, I wanted to give Delaware a shout out because their government website, Delaware.gov, has a whole haunted section.
What?
Like, the public archives has a list of the most haunted locations in the state. So that's pretty cool.
Fuck yeah, bud.
Yeah. There's not a lot of information on the actual state website, but it's cool that they even mention it.
Right.
Minnesota does not have that.
Lame.
First up, the Oceanfront Addie C. Inn, located at the corner of Ocean View Parkway and North Atlantic Avenue in Bethany Beach, Delaware, is kind of this picture-perfect idea of what you envision when you think of East Coast relaxation. Like, if you're going to watch a movie that's set on the East Coast on a beach, this is the place. It's got late Victorian architecture, classic cedar shingles, and that kind of gingerbread trimming.
Oh, yeah.
So the Addie C. has become one of Bethany Beach's most famous landmarks because it's also, like, really fucking old.
Yep.
John M. Addie, one of Bethany's original settlers, built the Addie C. for his family as a summer retreat away from their Pittsburgh home in 1901. Since he was a plumber, the Addie C. was one of the first in the area to have indoor plumbing and gas lights. Much of the original fixtures, such as the tin ceilings and fireplaces, have been restored to their original luster. So they've kept them in and, like, kept them up. The second generation of innkeepers began using the house for room and board at the beginning of the Depression. So not as an inn, but just a place for people to live. At some point around here, they've moved the locations around the beaches, which is pretty impressive. Like, just good old-fashioned hard work, taking things down and rebuilding them.
Like, picked up houses, moved them to different places?
Well, I mean, like, they disassembled them a bit first, but yeah.
Interesting. I'm surprised at how much that happens, or used to happen.
In 1974, the third generation of the Addies approached their neighbor, Leroy T. Gravett III, whose family had also been coming to Bethany Beach for three generations, about selling their property. Leroy decided to buy the Addie and started renovations, taking great care to remain true to traditions, but adding modern amenities. So, like, in the 70s, they updated the plumbing, updated the bathrooms, just made it a lot more comfortable.
That's good. But no 70s decor? Because
there are no 70s decor.
Oh, thank goodness.
In 2016, Jeff and Sherry Gravett became the third generation of innkeepers to tend to this beautiful, grand home by the sea. Today, the Addie C. Inn is a gorgeous, classic 12-room bed and breakfast for adults only.
Oh,
but not like,
so you can really party.
In the weird porny way. In the, like, classy way.
No screaming children allowed.
Right. It says right on their website that they book for 21 plus adults only. My guess is so that people can fully relax rather than hear the scampering of little feet and giggles roaming the hallway at random times.
I mean, unless there are little ghost children who are doing that.
Well, but because it's kid-free does not mean you'll be fully undisturbed. According to Haunted Rooms, it is reported that at least three rooms in the Addie C are haunted. There have been accounts of spiritual activity in rooms 1, 6, and 11 the most. Room 1 is said to have a haunted bathroom. It's got this beautiful, classic, old bathtub. Some sources claimed that it is an original bathtub from, like, 1901 when it was built.
Like a clawfoot bathtub?
Like a bronze bathtub.
Oh, my God. Pretty.
And supposedly that might have been the bathtub that John Addie used as, like, him and his wife's master bath.
Oh, okay.
The tub is said to shake violently.
Oh.
There are dozens of claims of this, some guests saying that it happened while they were in the bath.
No. Mm-mm. Mm-mm. It sounds really relaxing because those tubs are so nice and deep. But if it's all of a sudden going to shake violently, like, that is the opposite of relaxing.
Organ music can be heard coming from room 6, even though there is no organ in there.
Okay, that's weird. That's a weird haunted thing.
And room 11 is rumored to be haunted by the Addie's handyman, Paul Delaney. And Delaney's ghost is said to sometimes be seen in or near the bed.
Ew. Okay.
In March of 2016, a TripAdvisor rated the B&B and specifically included that they stayed in room 11 in their story. And they said, "Our stay had a purpose, and we were not disappointed. If you are into hauntings, room 11 is a must. It is the room that Captain Addie fell to his death from while trying to climb onto the roof." I saw no other claims of that, but they said that our experience included the jacuzzi turning itself on and our phones powering off when we tried to record it. The hostess we spoke to says that both electricians and plumbers say that there is no reason for this, but yet it happens. We were never scared or uncomfortable and would stay again. Aside from the three haunted rooms, there is a report of a ghost that runs through the hallways of the bed and breakfast during the evening. The smell of perfume will fill the air, and the sound of mysterious music floats through the hallways at night. Footsteps can be heard on the roof at night, which are especially made by the ghost of Kurt Addie, who fell off the roof to his death years ago.
And this is all from that one TripAdvisor thing?
No. TripAdvisor just was where ended where they said they would stay again. These are other reports that have come up.
Okay, so this guy really did fall off the roof.
He really did fall off the roof. There's just no reports that he left from room 11.
Okay.
Room 11 seems to be tied to Paul Delaney for most reports.
Right.
A post to Haunted Places from December of 2017 by a user named Sindar, he backed up that footsteps claim. He said, "I've stayed there 3 times, and one time while I was in room 10, I heard footsteps on the roof. I was a bit scared, and we were the only people staying that night." They confirmed it the next day.
I don't know what other guests would have to do with the footprints on the roof, though, because no matter what, no one should be on the roof, especially at night. That is unsafe.
Especially, like, it's not your home. Like, climb on your own house roof all you want, but if you're staying at an inn, maybe stay inside.
Don't. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like a liability. Just, like, don't. Just don't.
It doesn't seem like the staff at the Addie C are really embracing their haunted lifestyle. While I could find nothing that outrightly shuns it on their website, there is no mention of the hauntings on their history page or any of the about pages. And I haven't found any big paranormal research articles. So this could be that just no one's tried it yet. But with the regular activity being reported, I find that surprising.
I agree that if TripAdvisor has multiple things on it, one would think that someone would have been like, you know, we should go check that place out.
Yep, I'd chance a much bigger guess at the fact that they don't super welcome that sort of experience. They want it to be a nice, relaxing place for adults, not a place where they see people walking around with EMF readers.
I mean, lame, but okay.
Actually, in reply to that TripAdvisor review from the one on Room 11, Maggie V, the general manager at the Addy C, said, "Thank you for your review after your stay last March. I remember you and the laughs we had over the tub situation. We all know that there are no ghosts. We do know that, don't we? But it still makes for interesting and lively conversations." And I was like, damn, fucking Maggie B, way to call out your fucking people that said they would stay again. And you're all like, we do know, don't we?
We do know, right?
We do know, right?
You're so dumb. Just kidding. Don't come back.
So that's the Addy C. Again, if you're looking for spooky, maybe just don't advertise that you're looking for the spooky, I guess.
Yeah, Maggie will gaslight you.
If you're looking for an inn that embraces its haunted history, you may want to head away from the beach about 25 miles west to Georgetown, where you can find the Brick Hotel on the Circle.
Okay.
18 The Circle, or The Brick, is a 14-bedroom hotel in The Circle in Georgetown, Delaware. It is a 185-year-old building that has gone through generations of visitors, both alive and not alive. The original structure was built by local Delaware construction guys Joshua S. Layton and Caleb B. Sipple in 1836. These men also built the Sussex County Courthouse right across the circle, so they were big in that town.
Mm-hmm.
This
in that neighborhood.
Yes. In its nearly two-century-long lifespan, it has gone through a variety of business changes. During the Civil War era, the building was called the Union Hotel. At another point, it became a public housing building for people who needed assistance. Many decades later, in the 50s, it became a bank, the Wilmington Trust Company. And when the bank closed, it became an upscale inn for people to enjoy the historic community of Georgetown and for people who wanted to travel to the historic downtown area and have a nice place to stay to just keep them in the vibes. Burton C. Baker, the original innkeeper, was the one who owned it before it was a bank, and he was able to make the hotel a nice, neat place to go and visit. So he's the one that really maintained it at that point. And it sounds like when it was a bank, they kind of kept, even though they had to change it into, obviously, officialness, they kept a lot of the original structure.
Oh, nice. Just added a big old vault.
Today, the Brick Hotel is considered a rare building because there are only a few buildings like it that have been so well maintained over that long of a lifespan. For the last 12 years, Ed and Lynn Lester have been the owners that love to share the Brick Hotel with their guests and ghostly friends. But they weren't believers right away.
They never are.
According to Haunted Rooms, it is believed that the Lesters may have begun stirring up the ghostly haunts in 2008 when they did renovation work to the property.
Oh, we all know what happens when you renovate.
Ghosties come out to play.
They don't like it.
Over the years, many ghosts appear in the home, in addition to other just strange occurrences seen by staff and guests. Lynn's staff members refer to two of the most seen spirits as George and Ophelia, who like to play around and are generally friendly with all people.
Generally? Are they sometimes not?
Well, no, I just think, like, I don't know, like, there's no malevolence, but maybe they're not always friendly. Maybe they're just there.
Maybe sometimes they're just very cat-like and just knock things down.
They're just like, fine. I see you're here, but I don't want your attention right now.
That's legit. I'm generally friendly, I think, is how people would describe me. And sometimes I'm less friendly.
The Lesters were also told that former bank employees, when it was the Wilmington Trust Company, they were uncomfortable at night while in the building. And due to the evidence of the session with a medium, where they got EVP recordings on there, Lynn Lester finally began to just really believe. So the reports that were happening while they were doing the renovations, combined with the evidence from the people in the bank, and then they brought in a medium who got some EVP recordings, she was like, all right, I believe you.
I think this place might be haunted.
During that paranormal investigation, which was well over, I think it was like 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
motion detectors and other gadgets were used that detected movement, and the EVP captured these words. That's a classic.
Okay.
You needn't bother.
All right.
That's my broken bone. And medical.
Okay. I mean, the last two go together.
Well, it seems like it could maybe be attributed to the time that it was a hotel during the Civil War, was their kind of way that they attributed it.
That makes sense, but I would hate to be in a situation where I'm like, oh, that's my broken bone over there. Yeah. Can I have that back? Like, it's my broken bone.
Psychic medium Donna Smith and her husband, Revan, and other investigation team members from Delaware also used night vision cameras to check the paranormal activities, and they were able to confirm there are several spirits in the home, and one that they encountered is most likely female or someone with a very feminine side. They did not back that up with any reasons as to why, but they're a medium, so like, maybe that's just the vibes they were getting.
I do like, though, that they were willing to be, like, perhaps it's not like what we would traditionally call a woman, though. Maybe they're just a very feminine
presence. Smith held a seance in 2008 and did the tarot card reading at an event in the hotel. And she said, we had communication here, and it would be nice to get more for the history of the building. We do this for fun. Spirits are real. Which I thought was a weird quote, but...
That is a weird quote. We do it for fun. Spirits are real.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Maybe that should be our tagline for the podcast. We do it for fun.
Spirits
are real. Left of skeptic. During that seance, many people who took part said they felt cold spots in the room and that there were noises that couldn't be explained during the events. Witnesses also saw a figure of someone or something down one of the hallways.
Okay.
In the more recent times, many staff members have witnessed lights shutting off. On several occasions, randomly lights flashing and going just like absolutely haywire. Mostly the staff attribute this to George or Ophelia, but nobody is really sure which ghost is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're there, you could take some video if you have, of course, the permission of the owners, because we always say to ask, get permission first of the owners. It's said that guests and staff have witnessed doors opening and closing when no one is physically moving them.
Okay.
And they've been able to capture it, though I couldn't find any actual video of it. It's just them reporting that they were able to capture it.
What was the EVP? That's a classic.
That's a classic. At night, sometimes the showers turn themselves on, which I don't like that. Why does it bug me so much when it's a shower?
I don't know. I feel like the shaking bathtub would be the worst.
I know. I think I attribute too many like horror movies of like, oh, it's behind the shower curtain. Maybe that's where my brain's at.
That makes sense.
And many paintings have been seen at night to be moved or relocated with ghostly hands. Nobody knows who's doing it.
Just moving those paintings around.
Sometimes, right. If they're crooked, Ophelia or George, they want it straight. They're just
are
trying to make the place
or
look
are they
nice.
Like, that is not where those belong.
Sadly, we may have to wait and see if this building will still be visitable in the upcoming years.
Okay.
Lynn Lester said that despite relief grants, the coronavirus pandemic and state mandate restrictions on social distancing have taken their toll on their business, as we've seen around the world. Mm-hmm. So they were approached by the State Department of Justice to lease the building. And as Lynn said, timing is everything. So that's what they did. The Brick Hotel closed the restaurant and inn side of it and began leasing the building to the State Department of Justice on August 28th of 2021. And there is no indication as of right now if it will return to its setup as an inn and restaurant.
What does the State Department want with it? I'm so curious.
Well, it's probably just another office building that they can rent for cheaper.
Yeah.
Especially if it's in the center of Georgetown, which is a big deal town in that area.
That's true. I was really hoping you would go straight government conspiracy and say that they were going to try and prove that ghosts are real and they picked this location and they're like, this is the perfect opportunity.
No, I don't think the government's that fucking smart.
We need the evidence.
They're too busy stripping away, you know, my rights to give a shit about the paranormal.
Facts. Yep.
Oh, we just took a sad turn. All right.
We did.
Abortions are healthcare. So that is the story of the Addie C. Inn, where there's lots of documentation and they don't really want to talk about it, to the Brick Hotel, where there's not as much documentation, but they will totally talk about it.
They love to talk about it. Just like those ghosts love to move those paintings.
Exactly. Just like, you know, it's a classic. That's a classic.
It's a classic.
That's a classic. On a skeptic scale of para to normal, para being 5, normal being 1, what do you give the Addie C and what do you give the Brick Hotel?
I'm going to give the Addie C and the Brick Hotel both a 3.5.
All right. I was going to go 4.
I don't know why I'm such a downer right now, but
I'm going to say 4 only because, like, and this is something you wouldn't know, but it's something I know.
Okay.
Is that
secret information?
No, it was just, there were legit news articles. Like, sometimes I pull from websites that are, like, blogs because there's nothing better to find. But these were, like, legit news articles. So.
That's awesome.
I'm choosing to roll with it. Right. I'm going higher. I'm going 4.
All right. I love that for you. I love that for you. Let's see what you think of mine.
All right, let's do it.
Well, I've given y'all 2 straight weeks without it, so to probably no one's surprise, I'm going to tell you about a haunted mansion.
Ah, yes, your bread and butter.
My bread and butter. You know how I love haunted, very large establishments. And this week, I'm going to go to North Carolina, which, as I said at the beginning of the episode, I don't think we've done a story from before. I searched it. Couldn't see anything. Nothing popped up.
I don't think we have either.
Oh, yeah, you scared me real big when you said that. I'm like, oh, no. Someplace we haven't gone? Oh, no.
Well, I did have, but it's okay. Just in case it happened, I did have a backup story. I just didn't want to have to use it.
I mean, same. I never want to be like, Kayla, that's my story. Specifically this week, we're heading to Raleigh, North Carolina, to the Mordecai Manor.
Mordecai?
A.K.A. Yeah, which is a sweet name.
Badass.
I used to work with a guy named Malachi, and I was like, God, that's a fucking cool name, Malachi. Yeah. But this guy's name is Mordecai, A.K.A. the Mordecai House, A.K.A. the Mordecai Plantation, A.K.A. the Mordecai Mansion.
All right.
So this Manor House Plantation Mansion was built in 1785, and it is the oldest house in Raleigh that is still in its original spot. So all of my sources specified that. So I think that there are a lot of really old houses in Raleigh that just got, like, picked up and moved someplace else, which is weird that you also brought that up in your story.
They out here moving houses in the past.
It's so weird. It seems like so much work. I would just build a new one.
Materials. Spendy.
Yeah, but they had way more materials available. Unlike now, when you can't even get wood. I want to redo my deck. Can't. That was a weird tangent. Anyway, the oldest portion of this house was built in the center of a massive 5,000-acre plantation owned by a man named Joel Lane. And it was one of the largest plantations in the county. And Joel, who is considered to be one of the founders of the silly, as silly city, silly Brittany, it's a city, not a silly. Joel is considered one of the founders of the city, as Raleigh was also built on a portion of his massive plantation. So Joel built the manor for his son Henry and Henry's new wife, Polly. Henry and Polly had four daughters, Margaret, Temperance, Harriet, and Anne, and the six of them lived comfortably in this one-and-a-half-story, four-bedroom home. Also, likely to no one's surprise, given the date and location of this house, the Lane family also lived quite comfortably because they also claimed ownership over 14 enslaved people who worked in the home. They cooked, they took care of the horses, they did the laundry and the chores, and of course, they took care of the four daughters.
Holy crap. There's a lot of names to remember in this one.
Oh my God, you just wait. It's so many repeating names, but I tried really hard to make it so it made sense.
Okay.
Well, let's see. Let's see if it makes sense or if it's just a confusion of name salad. So in 1797, at the age of only 33, Henry Lane passed away, and Polly and her daughters remained in the house until Polly herself passed away in 1813. According to the Raleigh Register, she, quote, died in the vicinity of this city on Tuesday after a lingering illness, which she bore with great fortitude. In the 47th year of her age, Mrs. Lane, widow of Mr. Henry Lane, unquote. I just liked it because she had a lingering illness, but she bore it with great fortitude. And I was like, she seems pretty cool. In 1817, Henry and Polly's eldest daughter, Margaret, who also went by Peggy, married a man named Moses Mordecai. And Moses Mordecai was an up-and-coming lawyer in Raleigh, and gasp, was from one of the very first Jewish families in the city. So Peggy was an Episcopalian.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm saying that right.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right.
Okay. So considering that this was the early 1800s, one can only assume that this meant a darama, which one of the sources said that her grandfather, who all of the four daughters moved in with, I think until they came of age, refused to go to her wedding because he was Jewish. And that's super not cool.
Religion is so fucking weird.
It is. But I will say that the Mordecai family was actually a very prominent family in the Raleigh area. So hopefully the rest of the family was like, I don't know, he seems cool.
Hopefully. Hopefully.
Anyway, so Peggy and Moses Mordecai, this is obviously where the house got its name. And they were married and they had two sons named Henry and Jacob, as well as a daughter named Ellen. But 7 years after their marriage, Peggy died during the birth of their fourth child. But then, 3 years after that, Moses married Peggy's sister, Anne.
I don't like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to give away because there's a moment where I'm like, oh, that's why that happened.
Okay.
So that same year, Moses hired an architect to enlarge the house. And by 1826, 2 years later, the Mordecai Plantation House had been transformed into a Greek Revival-style mansion with four additional new rooms, which was probably a godsend since the entire family moved in with them. When Moses and Peggy had moved into the manor, so did Peggy's three unmarried sisters, Temperance, Harriet, and Anne.
Okay.
Which is how Moses and Anne probably got together afterwards.
I don't like that. Mm-mm.
Then when Peggy died, Moses married Anne, and then his two brothers moved into the house as well. Just a whole full house full of sisters and brothers, and I can only hope that sexy shenanigans happened, even though this was the early 1800s.
You say you can only hope that that happened?
Look, if you're going to live in a house with that many unmarried people, one would hope that there is some sort of fun shenanigans
happening. But they're all family!
Obviously. Well, they're not like related. They're related by marriage. Anyway, obviously it happened to one of them because Moses and Anne hooked up after Peggy died.
True enough.
I'm saying. So Moses went from being an up-and-coming lawyer to like one of those hotshot lawyers, and he was elected to the state legislature, and he also began a cotton plantation on the land that the mansion sits on. And I'm not sure what grew there before, but it sounds like he was the one who started that whole cotton thing. And it became very successful thanks to the many enslaved individuals who worked the land. And no thanks to Moses because he did none of the work.
Yes.
Eventually, Anne and Moses had a child of their own who they named after Anne's sister and Moses's first wife, Margaret. However, Moses died actually 6 weeks before little Margaret, number two, was born. Moses left Anne everything, and I assume that she lived out the rest of her days in the Mordecai Manor. They just stopped talking about Anne, though, so I guess I don't really know for sure.
But, I mean, that would track. They all lived there. Why wouldn't they all just keep living there?
Right, exactly. All those brothers and sisters who aren't actually brothers and sisters with each other. Henry Mordecai grew up, and at the age of 21, he inherited Mordecai Manor. He married a woman named Martha, and they had four children. They had Martha, obviously named after her mother. However, they called her Patty,
okay,
which was his aunt's name.
Okay.
Mary, second daughter, Mary, which was the actual first name of Polly, Henry Lane's wife at the beginning of the story. Her name was Mary. They called her Polly. So they named their daughter Mary in honor of Mary Polly.
Okay.
There's a Margaret, which is a name we've already come across twice in this story,
mm-hmm,
and another Moses. So this kid was named after his grandfather. Why people needed to repeat names generations and generations back in the day, I have no idea, but it's stupid.
Well, people still do it now, but you know what? Like, fuck a family name. Come up right with something else. Fucking yeah. just name one of these,
like, Malachi.
Children Ashley.
What a cool name.
Just Ashley.
Malachi Mordecai? Oh, he sounds evil. Malachi Mordecai. Anyway. Sadly, little Moses died when he was only 4 years old, though I'm not actually sure how. Later on, when I was reading some other stuff, they didn't go into any details, but it sounds like there was some sort of accident that could have been preventable but wasn't. But no one really told me what happened with him. But Moses passed away. He was only four. When the Civil War came to North Carolina, the family managed to survive with their house intact. And then they even managed to be able to pay the really high tax penalty that was placed on former plantation homes. But without all of the free labor of enslaved people, the family was unable to use this massive acreage of land for planting. They just didn't have the bodies nor the know-how because they've never done any actual work themselves. Instead, George Mordecai, Henry Mordecai's brother, suggested that they donate the land to the community. Henry and Martha were like, yeah, that sounds great. So, quote, in 1867, George Washington Mordecai donated the land east of the city to establish a Confederate cemetery. Gross. But then he donated another plot for Wake County's first Hebrew cemetery, which, honestly, I'm a little confused as to why there wasn't a Hebrew cemetery before that, because his very Jewish family had lived in the area for at least 60 years, so I don't know where all his former folks were buried. Like, where did Moses go? Where was Moses buried?
But if there's a lot of them in that one family, but
oh, that's true,
there's not a lot of other families, then maybe they had, like, a small, like, on-property burial ground, which was pretty common back then.
That makes sense. Anyway, when Henry died in 1875, Martha knew that she couldn't afford to keep the land as is, so she started selling off all the equipment until she only had what she needed to run a small farm. Then, when Martha passed away, her daughter Patty took over. And let me tell you, Patty, damn good business lady. So she started selling off bits of the family land that they didn't need and then investing that money into other developments around Raleigh. And she brought the family back up to a quote-unquote well-to-do status before her death. When her sister Margaret's husband died, Margaret and her five sons moved in with Patty. So it's a pretty good thing that she was making bank because feeding five growing boys is expensive.
I imagine so.
So then when Patty actually died, the youngest of the boys took over the manor. And then when he died in 1968, his surviving brothers and cousins decided that, you know what, it's time to sell the farm. Eventually, the city of Raleigh purchased the property, which included an entire block of land, for $60,000. The land was then turned into a historic park, and the manor was converted into a museum. And with the help of various charitable organizations and the citizens of Raleigh, the money was raised to buy all of the furniture and belongings that were still inside the mansion, allowing it to be an authentic museum. And this is said to have made the ghosts that inhabit the house very happy because it looked the same as it always did. And it is said that the spirits of all five generations of the Mordecai family come back to the house to visit.
You and your happy ghosts.
No, they're not all that happy. I don't know why they really emphasize the happiness, but some of them are kind of annoyed. But for the most part, they're fine. So, according to hauntedhouses.com, one afternoon after Mordecai Manor had closed to the public, a housekeeper was cleaning the dining room. When she had finished in the dining room, she had started to wipe down the woodwork by the doorway when she saw what she thought was a guide coming out of the library. This guide then proceeded to walk down the hall towards her. The housekeeper was wondering what this woman was doing here, as the guides weren't usually there when she was cleaning. And she described this mysterious guide as a pretty familiar-looking woman dressed in a long black pleated skirt and a white midi-type, I don't know what that means, blouse with a black tie. When the guide walked past the housekeeper, she didn't acknowledge the housekeeper's presence, just walked on by her like she owned the place. She held her head high, her eyes looking forward, and this really annoyed the housekeeper because rude.
Yeah.
Just some full-of-yourself guide walking around through onto the parlor. And the housekeeper was like, whatever, bitch, and went on cleaning. But then when the housekeeper had moved into the parlor to clean it, there was no one there. And seeing as there was no way out of the parlor other than to walk past the housekeeper, it dawned on her that this was no guide, that the fully formed, solid walking apparition was the spitting image of Margaret Lane Mordecai, who had a portrait hanging up somewhere in the manor, which is why she looked familiar. But the housekeeper is not the only one to have claimed to see her. Other visitors to the house report seeing a woman in a long black skirt with a white blouse wandering the halls or standing on the balcony at night. Some folks also report the spirit of 4-year-old Moses. He has been seen dashing up and down the halls and playing on the staircases, and this is what your first location was trying to avoid.
Okay. The sounds noisy of little pitter-patters?
Yeah. People have felt a sudden cold wind rush by them with no logical explanation for the cause, because he must run real fast.
Super fast.
And
fast as fuck, boy.
Super fast. Run, 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 run. And paranormal investigator Chris Roberts, co-founder of Past Researchers, said that his crew picked up on an unmistakable voice of a young boy talking while inside the empty house. Others have placed toys in one of the rooms thought to have been Moses's when he was alive, only to return to have them been moved as if played with. Miss Patty, the business-savvy Mordecai, is said to have let the staff know that she is not pleased. When folks are in her room and they say something that she does not agree or approve of, a small picture of Patty that sits on her bureau will suddenly fall with no explanation. Or it's a ghost cat. I don't know.
I mean, the ghost cat would make sense, but...
just fuck it.
Like, meh. But I do, if it is Patty, I like the idea that she's got this symbol where she's like, all right, enough. You know what this means.
Boom. You know what this means. Better stop talking about stuff like that. But Miss Patty doesn't always just use her ghostly powers to just push things over. It is said that she is also the spirit who will play the piano in the parlor. Many folks report hearing the sound of the piano playing, and when they walk into the parlor to investigate, they will see a gray mist-like apparition of a woman. Based upon the witnesses' descriptions, historians believe that this must be Patty. There also appears to be a male entity, thought to be the little kid Moses' father, Henry. Folks believe that he stays close to Henry, still not over the loss of his son at such a young age, which totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. But whatever his reasons for staying are, he makes himself known, as well as his annoyances known, when paranormal investigators come to the house. According to hauntedhouses.com, during one EVP session, the investigator asked the male spirit, "Do you want us to leave?" And a clear EVP was recorded as saying, "Yes, leave."
I mean, honestly, That's the most clear I've ever heard one of those, like, things be, where there's no interpretation. Like, no.
Yes, leave.
Fuck. Get out.
The investigator followed up with another question. He said, I'm leaving now. Do you still want me to leave? To which the male entity replied, leave, leave, leave.
Like, oh, I'm just going to ask that question in case you change your mind.
Do you really want me to leave?
Your...
Yes,
no, I did
leave.
Not change my mind.
Good God. I'm frustrated for him.
Did I stutter?
All right. But not all of the ghostly entities are attributed to the family. During the Civil War, although the house remained intact, soldiers found themselves fighting and dying in or near the structure. People who visit the house say that the apparitions of soldiers and medical personnel will still be seen on the property. Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters have visited the Mordecai Mansion, though when I tried to watch the episode, it was one of those ones that was like missing or out of order on Amazon.
Oh.
Just so frustrating. It said it was season 2, episode 4, but that episode took place in England, and this is in North Carolina. So I did not get a chance to watch it. I tried to find it elsewhere. I couldn't find it, but I did try. Just know, I think they've actually been there twice. So if y'all find it, just know that that's
just
that's
shoot a link.
Please shoot a link. Oh my God. Thank you. Yes, that's what I want. And the Mordecai Manor even has its own resident paranormal team. They call themselves the Ghost Guild, and you can find information on them as well as the Mordecai Manor Annual Haunted Festival, which is actually coming up on October 29th, 2022 at theghostguild.com.
Hmm.
And that is my information about Mordecai Manor.
I'm still floored of, like, at towards the end of your stories, there's usually one section that sticks with me the most. Uh-huh. And the part that has stuck with me the most so far is just
leave.
The very clear EVP. The extremely clear EVP.
Leave, leave, leave.
Leave, leave, leave.
Did I stutter?
Yes, leave.
Do you want me to leave? Yes, leave. Are you sure you want me to leave?
On that EVP alone, on the skeptic scale, I'm going to give it a 5.
Damn. Okay, I was going to give it a 4. You're much more believable today.
My skeptic is less. I'm slighter skeptic than norms.
That was a sentence.
Well, and it's not just. I mean, the EVP is very strong evidence, in my mm-hmm. opinion. But also, right. That is a lot of generations to be in a house. I do think that families. I mean, as long as they like each other, I guess. Give off a certain energy when they're able to spend that much time and stuff. And I think generational households are more likely to be haunted than, say, like ones that have had a lot of people in and out that aren't related.
I could, you know, yes.
Because it gives a different vibe.
I fully agree with that. Yes, it's like the energy is more
condensed,
planted, confirmed, it's saturated.
Something like that.
Yeah.
We can word today.
We can word real good today. Leave.
Yes, leave. Well, I mean, actually, we're not that far off from leaving because I do not have a Reddit story or a listener story today.
You know what? That's okay. That's okay.
So if you do have a listener story you would like to share, some haunted experiences of your own, you know, maybe you saw a cryptid somewhere, like maybe you saw that Mothman Big Booty, you can send it to us. You can send it to our email, leftofskeptic@gmail.com, or you can visit our website, www.leftofskeptic.com, and click the listener story at the top of the page. Or if you are listening in, you know, Apple, Google, Spotify, you can click the link tree right in our bio.
I mean, also, if you're going to be there, you should totally just give us 5 stars and a review. Also,
subscribe, you know, all that fun stuff.
You know.
You can choose to remain anonymous or include your name, whichever you'd like. We just ask that you please include your pronouns because we want to make sure that we are properly identifying everybody.
Yes. You can also follow us on social media. We are on TikTok, Twitter, and Instagram at Left of Skeptic, and Facebook at Left of Skeptic Podcast.
Well, the heat's gotten to us. We can word good. We love you all very much. Happy Spooky Wednesday.
Yeah. Happy Spooky Wednesday.
Okay.
We appreciate you.
We appreciate you. Okay, bye.
Bye. The Left of Skeptic podcast is written and hosted by Kayla Moria and Brittany Lind. This week's episode is edited by me, Brittany Lind. The Left of Skeptic music is by Dave Melling and Emily Havoc, and our artwork is by Al LeBlanc. Okay, bye.
There was a Saturday, got to have a whole, Jesus fucking Christ. We get it. You have a small penis. Ring, ding, 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 ding. And they always slow down so fucking much outside my house. All right. I was enjoying just sitting there. Had a whole conversation with my friend John.